of people in Raqqa to educate them about what's going on.
Aziz, before we end, tomorrow Trump and Vladimir Putin will meet. What about Russia's role right now with and against, in both situations, it seems, the United States in Syria?
Yes, so, like, Russia has been playing, like, a main role in the Syrian conflict, the same as U.S. Russia, like, before the, like, in 2016, killed people more than anyone, especially in Aleppo, and they're in charge of fighting extremism, and they were killing civilians all the time.
So now the numbers being killed, more being killed by the United States and Russia than by ISIS.
Yes, so the thing right now, like, it would be great if we'll have, like, a non-fly zone. We've been talking about non-fly zones when when the revolution then turned to conflict started. So we were asking to have, like, a safe area to the civilians to go there and stay in case they want to be out of this conflict between all these countries. It's not a local issue anymore. It's like a proxy war between, like, Russia, U.S., Iran, Hezbollah, thousands of groups, tens of countries are fighting each other in Syria, and every one of them has, like, interests in Syria. So we want to have, like, the Syrian people out of it. So right now, like, the Syrian people, they want to just survive all what they are thinking about how to be alive for the next day. And they don't care about these, like, international conflicts that are taking place in Raqqa and Syria.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Abdelaziz Alhamza is a Syrian journalist and activist, co-founder and spokesperson for Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Chinarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 8:02. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Street Roots for those who cannot afford free speech. Street Roots creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper published weekly in Portland, Oregon, and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change online at streetroots.org. Voices from the Edge is up next. Unfortunately, Joanne Hardesty is unable to be in the studio today, so this is an encore presentation on KBOO.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast.
Good morning. This is Joanne Hardesty. I've had the privilege of interviewing Michael Woods, who sees himself as a police scientist, and so we're going to get into that in just a few moments. He is here visiting Portland, talking about a model of fundamentally revitalizing how policing happens and who police are accountable to and the accountability system that goes along with that. So, Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here, Joanne. I'm proud to be here in Portland and enjoying your nice, quaint little city. It's enjoyable.
Oh, yes, and of course, the sun that you see, we have that always, so that's the myth.
Don't think that's true.
Well, welcome. It is so nice to talk to you. So let's tell the listeners a little bit about your background. So what I know about you is that, you tell us, what, give me like your five-sentence bio. Who are you?
So I'm one of those kids that grew up in suburbia, subsidized housing, mixed race kind of neighborhoods, watched cops on TV, saw the glorification of the Marine Corps. Being poor, your way out and into out of low class is through the military and education through the military. So I joined the Marine Corps when I was 17. Mm. My skill translates out of there to what? Policing. So always wanted to go back to Baltimore and police locally. I don't know. I guess you have in your idea at that time when you're a kid that, you know, cops are heroes and you want to be that. I wanted the thrill too. I don't ever shade from the fact that the idea of doing a car chase sounded like a pretty fun thing to do. So I was very motivated to go in policing. I wanted to help, but I also wanted the thrill seeking of it.
And tell me the timeline. So, I mean, you look like you're about 20 now, so I suspect you're a little bit older than that. What year was it that you joined the Marine Corps?
So I joined the Marine Corps, and I guess I officially signed the contract in 96. Mm. I left in 97 when I was 17. And did my 4 years in the Marine Corps, joined the police department in 2003.
Okay.
Retired in January 2014 from an injury after being in major case narcotics, after being a knocker, patrol officer in each of the different districts, and being a commander of different units. So I got a good view of what policing was at the same time that because we have this push for education and you have that GI Bill sitting there, I wanted to be professional. So I got a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. And so my story, I guess, kind of picks off there when I'm reading criminal justice literature and seeing policing on the ground.
Right.
And none of this is matching up with
not
reality.
Connecting. And you were placing in Baltimore?
Right. I mean, because you want to go where the action is in the bad neighborhoods. And so even when I started policing with the idea of a bad neighborhood, which kind of goes into this weird circle, because the first place I went and was a police officer with a badge on was walking the exact block that Freddie Gray was arrested on.
Wow.
So that ended up being this whole full circle where, like, I went into policing thinking these neighborhoods were so bad, like I had been taught, and being fearful there as a young officer.
So let me stop you, because where were you taught that these were bad neighborhoods?
America teaches you this. I mean, so policing looks bad to everybody, and we are recognizing it, but it's not policing. It's America. And police, just because of their power dynamic and because of the situations that they go into, they bring out and exemplify what we really are.
Right.
And what we really are is how I got to this position of policing, which is my theory on where American policing came from and where we have to research it if we want to kind of skip around, but
well, no, it's perfectly fine. My audience is used to me just going all kind of different directions, but I do want to talk about the history of policing. And so you're uniquely qualified because of someone who has a military background, which I want to talk a little bit about whether or not a military background is good or bad for policing. So we don't want to forget that. But I want to talk about, so you are a police officer. You are actually a commander in charge of police officers on the street while you're in school. Broadening your education capacity around policing. And I stopped you when you were talking about how you saw a disconnect there. Talk a little bit more about that.
The first disconnect that I saw was kind of the emotional disconnect where we've been taught that East and West Baltimore are dangerous. But I'm a white kid. I've walked through that. I was actually in major case narcotics squad when I was finishing my degree.
Okay.
So I'm out there on those streets, plain clothes, shorts, often no weapon. And these neighborhoods are not dangerous. I am not in any risk whatsoever. I know nothing's going to happen. It's a normal neighborhood. I don't understand what everybody's talking about.
Right.
I see drug dealers interacting in ways that are completely contrary to the zeitgeist that we have. So whenever you see a black drug dealer on TV up until at least 2010, they're always some kind of stereotype where they're bad and they have these influences coming in. But in reality, the drug dealers that I met were 17-year-old children who were struggling to survive, trying to make a few bit of bucks to send their little kid, their little brother, so he would have lunch at school that day or could get something when he got off the bus. This was just not the image that I saw at all. And it became clear that the very only separation between that drug dealer at the other side of the table from me was the fact of where I grew up, my whiteness, and not being checked by police. And you know, nobody checked me for drugs, but this dude's getting checked for drugs every day. Well, if I got checked for drugs every day, guess what? We ended up in the same boat. So those kind of things weren't adding up at all. Well, I really didn't get it together until, because I saw the disconnect, didn't know what it was. And I'm a manager, so I need to learn how to do management. So I went and I started doing my master's in information technology and business management so I could figure out what my problem was. And the metrics and incentives clearly don't align to anything that you want them to do. So that's where I really start seeing is how nothing is lined up for the goals that we want. Mm-hmm. So I started to think, where does this come from?
Right.
What happened here?
Right.
I just finished a criminal justice degree where they're talking about evidence-led policing and how this can take us on the right routes.
Right.
So I started snowballing my metrics backwards. And so, well, okay, so if we have accepted in our society that 18 to 24-year-old black males are the ones most likely to commit crime, so we focus our policing on that, why have we decided to do that?
Right.
So then you go, okay, so we're looking at them because they've been previously arrested.
Right.
Okay, so why were they previously arrested?
That's right.
And you change that back and you chase it all the way back down to the end to the first policing in America, which is unique from any other country in the world, where the police here ended up in Boston starting slave catching.
Yes.
So their very first metric was to catch a runaway slave who would most likely be a black male between the ages of 16 and 24.
Right.
And then you imprison them so you get a record.
Right.
So then the next step, you say, well, who do we look at? Well, the people that have criminal records.
Right.
So we're never actually judging people that commit crimes. We're judging and basing all of our information off of people we have selected to arrest for something because the crime is universal.
Now, I've heard you, and I want to let our listeners know, if you're just joining the conversation, I'm talking to Michael Wood. He is a police scientist who, do you have a master's degree?
Master's is finished. I'm doing finishing up my PhD now.
Working on his PhD.
I have my dissertation coming up right now, and as soon as that's over, I hope to never learn a thing for at least a couple months.
And so Michael Woods is here with me in the studio, and we're talking about policing. Policing across America. He's got real lived experience as a commander in Baltimore Police Department. And as my listeners know, that's my hometown, so near and dear to my heart. But ironically, Baltimore and Portland have a lot in common when it comes to policing because we have the same kind of data as to who gets targeted, who ends up being prosecuted. I don't know if you've seen a recent report that was in the Portland Tribune, but the title was The High Cost of Being Black in Multnomah County. And it talked about how from the police to the judge on the bench, every step of our criminal justice system is set up to ensure that black folks face much more severe consequences every step of the way. And so I know a lot more about you because I've watched your videos and I've listened to some of the talks that you've done. But what's your hope? I mean, here you are traveling around, you're a PhD student, you're traveling around talking to people about what you've experienced, both inside policing as well as the education of police officers. I've heard you talk about Department of Justice investigations, and we could compare notes of what Baltimore and Portland have in common as far as that's concerned. But what's your goal? What is your goal having these conversations, having these trips? What do you hope to see?
Well, one thing to address real quick is I do find it highly unlikely that there's any difference between Baltimore and Portland or any other city because this is an American issue.
Right.
So the education aspect is what I feel that I'm kind of stuck on right now. Mm-hmm. I would like to do other things, but maybe my envisionment of myself is like the Neil deGrasse Tyson of policing, whereas like neither one of us are going to be the greatest scientists, but we're trying to communicate to what that means to all of us. So in that history, what I'm trying to get people to understand now in these talks is why the policing cannot be reformed. It has to be completely rebooted because of that unique upbringing. And what you just highlighted was part of that unique upbringing, where policing in America is unique because it consists of three things that police are always doing at any point in time. And the first is the creation and maintenance of oppressed classes, and then using enforcement against those oppressed classes to actually fund their oppressors. So that's step one. We can see that easily in regressive taxation that you're talking about, bail reform issues, and the classes in themselves were created for this very purpose, so that you could take some poor white guy and think, you give him a badge, and now suddenly he thinks he's better than the poor black guy because he has a badge and some power. So you create that dynamic. The second thing that takes place is the prioritization over elite property over the lives of those oppressed classes.
Yes.
So the way to easily see that is going back to Baltimore's uprising, where if you watch the news or even if you pull up an article, you're very likely to see a picture of that CVS burning with cops lined around it.
That's right.
And the country was talking about, why would people burn that CVS down? And that is an expression of elite white power that the CVS is. So the police literally protect that line, when the whole time the only person that was ever killed in the Baltimore uprising was Freddie Gray, who was killed by the police. So they effectively created and maintained an oppressed class and protected the elite property there. And America thought that that was, in general, they thought that that was the proper way to do things.
Right.
The third thing is the continued genocide of the Native American people. So at all, and you obviously see all three of those completely encapsulated in what happened at Standing Rock and in Morton County PD.
Yes.
So when you see these things, you have to understand there's no way to reform that, because the power dynamic is completely wrong. It's a it's a private army for a mayor who's trying to achieve particular political goals. So people will be satisfied if they like their mayor, but it can't be about individuals. It has to be completely about the system. So I think the biggest fight now is understanding the history and why we can't depend on any individuals. This has nothing to do with Mike Wood. My work and in my model is completely based off of previously established theories that are implemented everywhere else. I don't have some great unique knowledge. I'm pulling together other smart thinkers and just presenting them to you to go forward.
Well, thank you for that. And so you have talked about Baltimore's agreement with the Department of Justice, and you and I share a viewpoint, a perspective, and that perspective is that the Department of Justice is not going to fix what's broken in police departments across the country. Just like in Baltimore's case, here in Portland, when we invited the Department of Justice to come to town to address the black and brown boys and men who were being killed at the hands of Portland police, they did a bait and switch and came in and investigated people with mental health issues or people perceived to have mental health issues. Thomas Perez, who was then the in charge of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, gave two answers for that. One is, you might know that at the U.S. Supreme Court, you cannot bring a case of racially disparate treatment without proving intent. And that played out in New York with stop and frisk. Wasn't until police officers recorded roll call directions to go out and arrest black and brown people that they were able to do away with stop and frisk. The second was the African American men who were killed in the 18-month period that the DOJ looked at were believed to have suffered from mental health issues. But again, no one believes that they were stopped because somebody thought they had a mental health issue. And so the Department of Justice, as you have articulated, incentivizes enhanced policing to address gang violence, to address drug violence, quote unquote. I am quoting that because their definition is black men between 12 and 24 years old, right? And so that's what we have here in Portland. The difference between Baltimore is we do not have a consent decree. What we have is a settlement agreement. So the police and the city admitted no wrongdoing, but agreed to spend millions of dollars to make Portland police officers first responders for people with mental health issues. So we think that's crazy, but apparently the DOJ thinks the solution to aggressive policing on people with mental health issues is to make the police the first responders.
Yeah, I found that incredibly interesting when you just said there that they didn't accept accountability.
No.
And Baltimore's consent decree is the first consent decree where they don't accept accountability either. It's in the very first paragraph.
Oh, so we didn't do anything wrong, but we'll spend a lot of money to fix what you think
exactly.
We broke.
So they deny everything in there. So the viewpoint that we share is just one of facts. DOJ consent decrees have never been successful anywhere. The cities that do these are New Orleans, Chicago, Oakland, Baltimore, New York, they're all the same.
Right.
You know, so no improvements have been achieved in those cities.
That's right.
And so there's no reason to believe that any justice decree would do anything because they're the same team. We already know this.
Right.
I mean, we call the state's attorney or the U.S. Attorney General, we call them the nation's highest law enforcement officer.
That's right.
So why would the nation's highest law enforcement officer not be just like everybody else's law enforcement officers who do cover for one another and the system, right, just like prosecutors do and have poorly aligned metrics? Of course.
Well, in fact, it is the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division that defends police officers for killing unarmed people consistently. Their rhetoric is, well, the police officer doesn't have a lot of time to make these decisions. These are split-second decisions, blah, 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 right? So it's even worse than they don't fix it. They've actually created the problem, and they reinforce the problem in local communities and as part of national policy. And now we have John Sessions.
Yeah, Sessions. I had a news thing about him the other day that we can highlight on. But so one reason why, even when I talk about the system, that whether it's Jeff Sessions or DOJ or anything like that, is because we can put somebody in there that makes us feel okay at the time, but as long as the system is constructed this way, it's going to be that way. So even a lawyer that says to themselves, well, I'm just going to do what the law says. So a judge can do that and make incredibly terrible decisions because of what has already been legally codified. So
that's right.
I mean, it takes more of that whole breaking of the entire paradigm. These cops, they defend them for shootings because fear is the standard.
Yes.
So think about fear being the standard. That's ridiculous. In the military, in the Marine Corps, I couldn't shoot unless I was shot at.
Right.
So, like, police don't even have that. They only have to be afraid that the person could possibly hurt them or somebody else.
That's
and
right.
then with the trials against the officers who killed Freddie Gray, or suspected of killing Freddie Gray, I mean, he's definitely dead, but which ones did it? We're never going to know because we always keep the truth hidden. But what they did there in that case that they codified into case law was that policing and their decisions of what they do, they're considered to be reasonable, right? So so an officer, what an officer does must be judged reasonable.
That's right.
What they've codified is that reasonable judgment comes from other officers.
Yes, yes, right. And not from normal people, right? Regular citizens in the community. Yes, that is absolutely true.
Right.
Which is why police officers know that they will be exonerated. They know they will get a paid vacation. They know that they will actually be promoted and looked highly upon after they have killed an unarmed community member. So there's really no incentive built in the policing to change that.
Yeah, I mean, because there's not even a check and balance. Like, so one thing we do know is that an officer that kills one person is incredibly more likely to kill a second person.
That's right.
And incredibly more likely to go a third and exponentially down on the line.
Right.
So, like, even if, so say that cop has done nothing wrong.
Right.
That cop can't be on the street.
Right.
We know scientifically he's incredibly more likely to kill somebody.
That's right.
So we should say, all right, well, I'm sorry that you did this, but we get him a desk job or we change the way we do things. So we have to totally revamp our entire idea that a gun and a cop in our neighborhood is what makes us safe, because that's also a false paradigm.
Yes, yes. And so let's talk a little about your model, right? Because one of the things that clearly stood out for me was, why do we have this huge administrative cost associated with policing, right? Just in record keeping, report gathering, personnel matters, et cetera, right? Your model actually takes that out of policing and puts the human resource functions under a human resource system. Right? So talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, it's that seems like reasonable and logical and...
Well, I mean, separation of powers is like management 101. Like, you know, that should have been put in the place to begin with.
Yes.
So we have officers generally checking other officers' reports.
Yes.
Which is preposterous.
Right.
It should make it through you before we determine whether it's accurate or not. And what my motto really comes down to is like, look, we shouldn't be doing policing. Policing is inherently violent. Mm. And we should probably be starting something that's based out of public health that we build up. But that's really difficult to get people to do.
Right.
So the only what I'm saying is that we already have this infrastructure in place of policing with a big, huge budget that everybody's already accepted that half of your tax dollars are spent on this thing that we can't even prove works whatsoever.
Right.
So we have to have a model that's specifically designed for abolishment. Policing, which is inherently violent. So to be police is to have violence extracted on you in one way or another. That's just what it is.
Right.
So we have to have a system that continually lessens the amount of guns and officers responding to situations. So we want something that's designed for abolishment, which means we're always trying to get the numbers down and things like that. But what I'm talking about, so people can conceptualize the overall model, is nothing new at all. So we're taking corporate social responsibility theory, which basically companies have realized that if you want to succeed for a short period of time, you can be ruthless and make a ton of money. But if you want to be around for 50 years, you better take care of the people, treat them with respect, make moral decisions and things like that. So companies are learning to do that, and that's where that theory comes out of.
Right.
So then we take stakeholder theory in business management, which is to take everybody that's subjected to your policing, and they actually control what it is because they're the ones that are the actual stakeholders. This is how successful companies are completely run.
Right.
So when we identify stakeholders, what gets hard for people to understand is that stakeholders are prostitutes, drug dealers, those are the people that actually get police services.
Houseless people, right.
So once you have the stakeholders in, you use a Delphi technique, which is a company that just uses a nice consensus building technique, in which we would meet with a group of stakeholders, like say you, and we go over what you want policing to be, and I argue with it with a bunch of scholars, and then we move to the next stakeholder, and we keep going around until we're all like, okay, this is what policing will be for us, because we have to build policing that's unique to you and your city and the way the laws are here, what your needs are. Like, for instance, Baltimore has a dirt biking culture. Well, policing should embrace the dirt biking culture and make it part of their thing, which may be completely inappropriate for Portland.
Right.
So you want to model it towards you because it's your police department. What we've been doing is we've been having a mayor have a private army for their goals of that short term, 4 year or 8 year goal that they're trying to achieve. So they use their private army, which Bloomberg admitted he had a private army, the seventh largest in the world, and he was going to use it. And that's what they do. They use it to stamp down those numbers. And remember, numbers, not actual crime.
That's right.
They stamp down numbers or increase numbers artificially, whichever way they want, make themselves good and achieve a goal.
Yes.
Well, I need at least 22-year goals, which you will care about, because the biggest correlate to violent crime in the entire world, besides economic, is lead poisoning. So, but yet, there is not a single police department in this country that's working on lead poisoning abatement because it's a 22-year goal. The payoff isn't until 22 years later.
Right.
Mayors don't have any 22-year goals.
That's right.
You have a 22-year-old goal.
Right.
So what we need that is that the police's metrics going in are aligned with the metrics going out. And that's where we hit our big barrier. So companies are run with CEOs and a board of shareholders. So this is exactly what we're talking about, is that the public would be the board, and you tell the CEO exactly what to do, and they serve you and your interests. So if your child, you don't want your child locked up for a flower in their pocket, which this state luckily and thankfully decided, no, we're not going to do that. So we're not going to do that to anybody.
Right. Anymore.
Right. Which is a dramatic improvement.
Yes, yes. Right. But again, it's don't go there, because in this state, the people who've gone to prison for marijuana possession, look like me, right? The ones that are making millions of dollars now look like you. So
that's that same way in Maryland and everywhere else, too. So that's a system that we have built into this, though.
Yes.
Okay, so one of the things we need to do is we have a discussion about what we want the police to do. We've already decided we don't want them to lock up people for cannabis.
Right.
So what do we want is, well, we want those kids that were selling cannabis to have a job.
Right.
Well, then we open up the legal dispensary right there, and we already have employees. So that has to be codified into the system as well, because one of the biggest problems with this is it's a gentrification magnet.
Absolutely.
So once you have control, then they're going to come in. So we have checks and balances for all those things. You have to be a resident for at least 10 years before you can even think about getting on the board and things like that, or what we need to put measures in for.
We are here in Portland on a national search for a new police chief. Interested in a job as a police chief?
No.
why not?
I'll consult. But for one, I'm in LA, and I've dedicated at least the next year and a half of my life to Veteran Stand and the work we do for social activism there. And hopefully, maybe I can leave that to somebody else in a year and a half and go do something. But right now, I think it's best that I consult, because I really think the person should be from the city. And I really think the police chief should always be somebody that came up through the entire police department, because remember, we're taking a lot of their power away.
Oh, that's interesting, right? Because maybe if the model that you propose was in place, I could see someone from internally being picked to be the police chief. But when you have a police department in the chaos that our police department's in, and we have a police department that the last police commissioner just opened up the vault and gave them as much money as they wanted and as much resources as they wanted and negotiated a contract he didn't need to negotiate. I could go on, but I won't. We need someone who doesn't have any skin in the game. They come in with a reform mindset. They come in with a vision about what's possible in policing, and they start pushing the daylight out of the dead weight that we have inside the police bureau currently, who thinks everything's just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'll agree with you that under the current dynamic, that an outsider is probably the best for a police chief. The problem is where they pick their outsiders from is the exact same club of everybody else. Oakland just hired the former Seattle commander, who still believes in broken windows, which was disproven a decade ago.
We have a former Portland police officer who just retired, Mike Leloff, who now is at the police training facility in Salem, BPSST, as a training officer, and he also believes in broken window policing theory. And under his leadership, in 30 days in inner Northeast Portland, 300 people were arrested. And that was called success, except it was supposed to get weapons out of the hands of young people, and 0.01 weapon total of the 300 people arrested was what the results of that were.
Have you ever seen the stats in New York City where, like, their stop and frisk data, where they actually find a gun on a black individual is like 0.00001%, and on white guys it's like 5%?
Yes.
Because they were actually policing when they saw the white guy. So they were actually looking for the signs instead But, you know, we can't blame the officers on that. It sounds hard, but they're in a system where they've been manipulated into these things. I believed all this and did all this at the time. No way am I above any of all those bad things and carrying out a career of racist actions. The problem is that I wasn't racist, and that's a serious problem, that I can be in a system that allows me and encourages me and blinds me to racism in my actions versus what's in my mind.
You raise an excellent point, because normally when you're having a conversation with police about racially disparate outcomes, the first words out of their mouth or their first thought is, well, I'm not racist. I don't see color when I police.
Which I say was my weakness. That was my blinding spot. I did try to do that. I wanted to be like RoboCop and treat everybody fairly according to the law and just go out and do my job and where I was. But what you don't see is, where I am,
right,
where they put me,
yes,
what laws I'm supposed to enforce.
That's right.
And all those things that come in. So my actions ended up being racist actions.
Right.
The day I realized I got assigned, and when I was a young patrol officer, I got put into a place called Mount Washington, which is like the rich elite neighborhood,
right,
and that I didn't even know existed in Baltimore.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I was taking pictures with my flip phone back,
right,
in the day,
right,
like just sending them to people like, oh my God, I am in Baltimore still. I'm driving through
check this out,
cross right, country boulevard with a stream to my left. Ooh. With $1 million houses.
Mm.
But I know that statistically there's just as many drugs in that neighborhood,
right,
as there are in the other neighborhood,
right,
but I'm not doing a single thing,
right,
in this neighborhood.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, you're looking for lost cats and
right, right. So if I'm but I'm doing the law,
right,
and I'm not changing anything, so it's easy to be blinded by it. That that was my whole problem. I didn't realize, right, I was arresting 95% black, right, men until I saw it on a piece of paper.
Wow.
Because that's where you were and that's what you were told to go do. And the whole country told you you were good the whole time.
Mm.
So that's what we got. It's so hard to stay focused on the systems,
right,
and not any of these individuals. Like, so even with your police chief, my model does not need me.
Mm.
And if it needed me, it would be a flawed model.
Mm.
All you need to do is put in the model. You need to be in charge. Would mm-hmm. I be good at giving you suggestions and carrying out what you want? Mm-hmm. Sure. But there's a tons of people that would be good at that. It's just that those metrics need to come from you.
I love that because you're absolutely right. And we continue to say that the DOJ will declare victory in Portland sometime over the next few years, yet those of us who live here will continue to have to fix what's broken within our police department. What I like about just kind of your vision and this kind of shift that you've made, I suspect that you're probably not that welcome in policing circles right now.
So I would largely disagree with that.
Oh, really?
Am I welcome?
Yeah.
No.
Hey,
I'm not welcome. I'm not welcome because you have that scourge of the. But I don't think they disagree with me. I think cops want this.
Mm.
I haven't had a scholar argue against me. I
right.
haven't had an officer really argue against me.
Right.
They want to do good things. A lot of us go in wanting to help. And if we had metrics that meant we could go introduce ourselves to all the neighbors, we
right.
would love to do that. You
right.
know, I don't want to go. I never wanted to go around locking somebody up for some bull crap. I mean, look, cops should be lazy, sitting in their car, talking to everybody, and you might be like, oh, I can't believe that guy's making $80,000 a year to do nothing.
Right.
But we want police to actually do nothing. That's our goal. If we can have a situation where the police are standing around going, man, I don't have anything to do but play football, then
with
good.
The neighborhood kids.
Take
right.
your gun off,
right.
you know, because one thing we don't need is guns everywhere. We
right.
need to continually work towards less guns on the street. Like, why we even have guns doing car stops is kind of baffles me, which people are like, oh my God, that's a crazy idea.
Mm.
But what's going to happen? I mean, like, nothing would change. The person, if they want to leave, then let them leave. We need to be reactive and do good detective work, because that's the only thing that has really ever worked when it comes to policing, is to do the detective work, figure out what happened, and resolve the situation intelligently. We don't need this instant gratification of, oh my God, that guy disrespected me, so let's make sure we put him into a prison cell right now or something like that. Like,
right.
we don't want to do those things, but the system forces us into those things.
Well, I think that the media has a lot to do with why police get away with killing unarmed community members. The narrative, and I think the police control that media narrative in a way that the public would never have access to. So, for example, how often have we all been inundated with the gang shooting story at 11 headline? And the image that comes into our mind is a black young man between 12 and 24 years old. And why is that? Because we've been conditioned to believe, because of all the press releases that the police put out about what crime looks like, what neighborhood is happening in, and who's the victim, as well as the person that's committing the crime. And it normally is black. They put that picture out. They pay people full time to do press releases all day to a lazy media who doesn't actually do investigative reporting. So when you go to that 11 o'clock news story, what you find is they've only talked to the police. They haven't talked to mom. Mom didn't say, little Johnny, I've been trying to get him out of that gang. No neighbor said, yeah, I told you that was a bad boy. He's been a bad boy his whole life, right? The only people they've talked to, the experts on what happened, are the police.
I mean, when you started that sentence, right, what I wrote down was, media will repeat police lines as fact.
Absolutely. That was
my line.
They do.
And see, that could be innocent, too, on the individual police officers that are doing it. So the media is too lazy, and they're just repeating their lines, not even thinking about what journalism is. And the police officers putting it out there, they're just as blind to the fact that their commanders are putting their officers in the black neighborhoods to do all this stuff. And then they're just like, well, what? This is the crime that we have. They're just not aware. That's why we have to be stuck on this educational aspect. Like, this blows a lot of people's minds. Do you know that you could be walking around the south side of Chicago as just you,
right,
or some white dude from Iowa,
right?
He is just as likely to be shot on the streets of Chicago as he is in that farm in Idaho.
Wow.
So not more dangerous.
Right.
It simply isn't.
Right.
And we live in the safest, most peaceful period in human history.
Yeah, because we go out and fight in other people's countries.
Like,
right?
Even this whole world, right, even the world's wars we have going on now are less than they've ever been.
Well, that's
so, like, that's true. We got to put things into perspective of what reality is that we have this situation where crime is going dramatically down,
yes,
while police is getting dramatically more powerful and militarized.
Yes.
But none of those militarization things or any police enforcement actions are actually tied to the crime being reduced.
Right.
We only have two huge periods of crime reduction in this country. The first started in 1972 when they took lead out of the gasoline.
Mm.
So nationally, all the crime started a huge drop in the 90s because there's a 22-year delay for maximum response for lowering lead poisoning.
Mm.
So we had huge epic crime reductions in America in the 90s. And then in the early 2000s, you see this epic crime reduction, which is tied to broken windows policing in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But New York's public health department attacked lead poisoning more than anyone else in the entire world.
Wow.
And they have their city the lowest lead poisoning of this country.
Right.
So that is why in the early 2000s, from their efforts of the health department in the 90s, they now have the lowest crime of any city per capita in this country because they fought the number one correlate to crime, but not through policing,
right,
through their public health department, and the policing gets the credit for it.
Wow. Just talking to you, I just realized I've known this for a while, the enormous hurdle that communities have to overcome if they're going to own their police force. Right? The first thing that you have to do is have a transformative leader who has a different vision of policing. What we've experienced here is we get people that look good, use the right words, are personable, but yet continue the broken, flawed policies that policing has become known for. In addition to that, I think that white middle class America is starting to recognize that there's something fundamentally wrong with how policing happens in the United States of America, and are starting to look for ways and opportunities to acknowledge that and find a solution to that. I think the challenge is that the change that has to happen is so enormous, right? It's kind of like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? It's so enormous that people just don't know where to start. My premise is we have to start in a lot of different places. We got to get the right new police chief. We've got to create a community demand for independent oversight of that police department.
Not oversight, direction. Oversight is a dangerous aspect because what we end up doing, and we've accepted, is that for civilian review boards,
right,
we will check the officers who have done wrong.
Right.
But remember then, we are judging officers by the outcomes and not addressing the people who are incentivizing them to do those actions. So you will never change anything other than punishing cops and putting them in a bigger corner because they're being given input that isn't aligned to their output. So you have to take that board all the way up to the top so that you can align the inputs and the outputs. Total control, not
Not overview, total control.
I stand corrected. And so what that would mean is we are now locked into a horrible police contract that our outgoing police commissioner negotiated long before it was necessary. He was leaving. Now he's out on his sailboat somewhere in the Mediterranean enjoying his retirement. While we are living under a contract that allows retired police officers to come back at full pay for up to 7 years. Now, these are the officers we really, really, really want retired, right? Because if they've been under false illusions of what policing should be, they should be gone. And we should be looking for a new generation with a new vision of what policing is. But anyway, so this contract, we are now forced to live. I won't say we're forced to live it, but it's a 4-year contract, right? So he negotiated last year on his way out to give the police some benefit. Here's the ludicrous part of that contract. Body cams has been presented to the public as a pancreas for police violence. So if you could see police officers on body cam footage, then of course they would be prosecuted if they did something that was unconstitutional. Now, Michael, you and I know that we've seen a lot of video all across the country of police officers doing unconstitutional practices. However, very few have been convicted of anything. So the last mayor negotiated a way that the police get to see the body cam footage before they write a written report. And if there's any video footage and they're being investigated, they get to see that footage before they're investigated. So basically, the minuscule accountability that would have been built into this multi-million dollar purchase and storage of body cameras and its data doesn't benefit the public at all. Zero.
These things are incredibly dangerous. So here's the problem with body cams. Mm. They're a tool. Mm. If you're in control of them, yes, like we're talking about,
right,
they're excellent.
Yes.
But the problem is what we're doing is we're giving police control of the camera.
Yes.
Which I had a camera every day I was a drug dealer. Oh. It was my weapon against the drug. Every day I was in narcotics unit.
Right.
I wasn't the actual drug dealer.
You were the cop. Right. You were the cop. Right. Right. Okay.
So I would have the camera all day long. Right. It was my tool of policing. So now imagine with our Orwellian escalation of policing, now when combine the cameras that they're in control of with facial recognition.
Yes.
And this future going forward, you have to be like, none of this works without you being in control of the actual policing. So I think that can be done most instantaneously by a radical mayor who will come in and just give up the power right away to the people. So I think it can actually happen super fast. Mm-hmm. And here's another trick. None of these law enforcement officer bill of rights or contracts, it don't mean anything.
Right.
Because what ends up happening is this, it's really simple. Mm-hmm. So we can do this in a scenario where I come in. All right, cool guys, you want to abide by this contract? Because I'm releasing all the data of everything we have done and every complaint that's against you guys for the last 20 years. So would we like to do a contract where we can indemnify you and make these things go forward and do it and start all over? Or would we like to stick to the old contract and just let everybody see all the old records? It's wow. Easy.
Wow.
They're not going to let the data out so that they can come and they can step. Here's another trick. We don't need this many cops.
Yeah. Oh, that we know.
So if half of them want to quit, quit.
Well, apparently everybody knew that in the city of Portland except the Portland City Council, because that was why the outgoing mayor had to negotiate this contract. There was they were in a policing crisis, right? They couldn't find people that wanted to be Portland police officers, so let's give them a 9% pay raise. Let's let the retired, arrogant, obnoxious, non-community police officers come back as fat cats feeding twice the same pay, because once for retirement and once for a full 7 years, right? police overtime has always been out of control in the city of Portland. And, of course, it's always the public's fault, because when we have protests, police officers have to be paid $1 bazillion to sit in conference rooms waiting to be called, right, to aggressively remove protesters, especially when there are protesters of color.
Violently remove them. Remember, policing is always violence going forward, no matter what the scenario you're talking about. And so you have all those mismanagements of funds and everywhere that you're sending it, that is all instantly solved with you guys in control. You're not going to spend the money on those budgets. And when you have things like, so the PM paid more money and doing that kind of thing, it's the creation and maintenance of an oppressed class and extracting resources from that oppressed class to continue their oppression. And this is just more of it,
right?
Because remember, these taxes are all regressive taxes that they get this thing from. So they're going to extract the resources from the poorest among us to continue to pay the cops more. And all they're doing is paying them more, trying to figure out where the line is that the morality will cede because they've been paid enough. So instead of changing the bar of how low their morality has to be, instead they're trying to pay them more when we could pay them what they're paying them if we would just make it a job that people actually want to do. They don't want to join, not because it's not enough money, because they don't want to be that person that's standing out there occupying a neighborhood brutal to people.
That's right. And quite frankly, at least in Portland, and I don't know how this plays out in Baltimore, you can tell me, at least in Portland, depending upon the complexion and of the protesters, so when white women protest, the police come out and they take pictures and they smile and, you know, they're just all kumbaya, right? When people of color organize peaceful protests, the police show up on flatbeds and riot gear and are the most aggressive, in-your-face force you can imagine. So I've certainly asked our mayor, do we have two police forces? One we call when white women protest, and then another when people of color protest.
I'm glad you said white women, because that was one of the things I heard from the Women's March in D.C., where I heard people saying, you know, oh, the police aren't that bad. It's like, it's a bunch of white women. Of course the police are bad. What are you talking about? Luckily, during the uprising in Baltimore, a couple of people, fairly large group of people from one of the white neighborhoods, made a statement to prove that exact instance during the curfew in Baltimore, where they were being violent and locking everybody up on North Avenue.
Right.
And then over in the white neighborhood, which was walking distance, they were staying out past curfew with signs being like, we're out here, you know, this is obviously you're not messing with us.
Right.
And they eventually dealt with them all peacefully and nice, while at the same time they were firing tear gas over the other side.
But I think that really reinforces how policing has evolved in the United States, right? It really, really is clear to folks who are paying attention that policing happens different based on the color of your skin. I have become a big fan of outcomes, because I've been having this conversation with 8 police commissioners, 12 police chiefs, well over, 15 years, 20 years of having these conversations about reforming the system, right? And some have been decent people. Some, it was clear that they were committed to reform. What I have experienced is that when reform is really taking place, when it's not just buzzwords and talking points that a police chief uses in their press conference, when reform is really taking place, the rank and file rebel. They push back, they complain, they file lawsuits. Has that been your experience?
That avenue is from an employee that's been a member of, you know, the police union. Those things tend to come from, because what's benefiting us is being taken away.
Right.
So that usually comes to cars, pay, vacation, things like that. So they're not actually pushing back on their enforcement actions. I mean, some of them are completely ignorant and they think that violence and control works.
Right.
But vast majority are learned over time. I mean, you can always hear stories of the veteran officer being like, you can't talk to them like that. You know, it's going to go wrong. So eventually everybody pretty much learns it anyway, that that's not how to interact with the public and going forward. So, I mean,
that's the incentive system. The incentive system, as you articulated from the beginning, right, is how many arrests did you make? Right. How many convictions did you get?
Right. So they don't want to do it. It's just that they know that's their metric. So if you're making their metric harder to achieve, they're going to complain. But if you change the metric, the complaints out the window. They just, what we end up doing is the misaligning the incomes and the inputs and the outputs. That's what it looks like,
right,
is when a cop can achieve career success,
right,
through multiple arrests,
right,
but then when you do multiple arrests, you get you risk punishment.
Right.
So it's that balance that they find themselves into as a pawn stuck between both sides.
Mm.
They really are stuck in the middle, the street cop is, because they're a pawn in a system that's being controlled by their commanders, and their commanders, which we also know from a Princeton study, and the mayors and politicians, they don't give a darn what you want as a citizen.
Right.
So you as a citizen and a society are judging the outcome, but someone else is controlling the input, so the cop's completely stuck in the middle with no right.
Okay, if you're just joining the conversation, I'm talking to Michael Woods. He is a police scientist. He is studying for his PhD, but he also has a background as a commander in the Baltimore Police Department, as well as has been educating himself on policing and policing practices across the United States. Give us hope, Michael. Where is the hope, and where do you see some bright lights as you've been talking to folks around the country?
I think my biggest hope is still rests in Baltimore. I don't think there's reform measures there, but the activists there, their intelligence, the way they've contributed to this, my education that I've received from them has been vastly superior to anything I have achieved in school. Like, the hardest thing that I had in this entire system was to figure out where we get our representative sample of the community.
Right.
Like, I couldn't figure out a way for it to not be corrupted.
Right.
And I was sitting in front of that very CVS when Dwayne Davis, who is an activist down there, his name is Shorty.
Right.
He was, I was talking to him, just complaining about this problem, and he had the answer. And I, like, that my ultimate penultimate problem was solved by a barbecue grilling Black Lives Matter activist in front of the CVS
that had been burned out.
That I needed that. Like, I was I was done without that piece.
Wow.
Because there was no way for it to not be corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the answer because he had that street knowledge, which is another aspect of education. It doesn't just come from the school.
Right.
The speech I gave in Loyola was talking about education and how it formulates your path. And that's what I really realized it does. This formulates my path.
Mm-hmm.
And my first path of education really started with Rage Against the Machine, the band, and how they were telling, it was the first rap and rock fusion, talking about the system and how it was crushing everybody and how we needed to fight back. And that was like the first seeds that got of revolutionaryism that got sown in my head.
Right.
And for my friends like Tariq and Kwame, it was Malcolm and it was MLK, but I didn't have that because I went to a white school where we don't learn those things.
Right. It's ironic that we consider Malcolm X and Dr. King to be American history, but school systems don't.
I don't, like, a lot of people would say to me, but you sound like X with some of the stuff you're saying.
Right.
And I had no idea.
And
so
like,
I go back, I look
that,
at it, and I'm like, oh my God, that dude was on point, you know? Like,
and now you know why he was taken out, right? Michael, I really, really, really have enjoyed our conversation. I really think that there are some opportunities here as we look for a new police chief, as the community gets more organized. Just this week, I met with a group of women who said, well, we're just moms from Southeast Portland, but we are really concerned with police killing children in our community, and we want to meet with the mayor, right? And so there are these pockets. I met with this rabbi the other day that came to a vigil that I continue to do for a young African-American man, Keith Notice, who was shot and killed by Portland police in 2010. She's like, I have this faith group that I've just developed with Jewish folks who want to be engaged and involved, and we want to work on policing issues, right? So I think that this is rising to the level of comfortable middle class white America that's all of a sudden realizing they got to do something, right? So I think the timing, I think maybe the election of number 45 has actually compelled people.
You mean the hood got taken off on our American government?
Hey.
So we saw the face behind it?
We saw the face behind it, absolutely. So I'm optimistic because of that.
Well, be optimistic because this is only a matter of time.
Mm.
Without doubt, the escalation goes this way. My problem is that I don't want this to take 20 years because I'll never be able to get off past watching Tamir Rice be murdered.
Right.
I can't like as a human being move past that moment.
Right. Right.
So every day that I'm delayed, that's what I see. And so we have to fight because I think anybody that sees that knows that that's not an acceptable future for any of us.
No.
And in the age of information, like even when it comes to our foreign policy, you just can't convince me that a Syrian 18-year-old male is my enemy.
Right.
You can't.
No.
So the Russia thing. Like, you can't convince me. Like, I can tweet somebody from Russia right now, and we can have a conversation where they think Putin and Trump are morons, too.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, these people simply aren't our enemy, and hopefully the age of information allows us to realize that a little bit more intimately because we can have our little groups. The family on the internet is actually, like, that tribal thing that can go further and allows you to see that it's just not your little group that matters.
Well, I think you raise a really good point. It is my hope that however we build this, that we build it in a way that's inclusive of a diverse perspective, viewpoints, experiences, because since the election, there have been a lot of new groups that have popped up. There are a lot of people that now get that we got to fix the police, right? And I think that's good and bad, right? Because the good news is that there's a lot more people paying attention. But again, the bad news is it's a lot more groups. So people are a lot more confused about what's the best use of their time and energy and resources, right? Well, I want to keep an eye on Baltimore because, again, special place in my heart because that's home for me. And I was devastated when I saw what happened in Baltimore and, of course, the narrative that was created around it. I think but for the grace of God, that could have happened in Portland at any time. And it's been because of leaders that have been working on this issue for a long time, I think, that we haven't had an urban explosion, rebellion, uprising, whatever you want to call it. But not because people aren't just absolutely frustrated that the outcomes, and you clearly talk like an academic, right? Because you talk about the inputs and outputs and and the matrix and that stuff. But I understand what you're talking about in the words that I use would be the outcomes, right? You say this is your vision of what you want, and then at the end of the day, you do an evaluation. And if the outcomes are radically different than what you said your vision was, then either your vision's wrong or the outcomes are wrong, right? And one of those have to fundamentally change. And I think that's where we are in Portland. So I hope that we will have the opportunity as we move forward to really implement some of your components. But as you mentioned, more importantly, is to make sure that it really is a Portland answer to a Portland problem that we can then have ownership of and leadership of.
Yeah, what I want to do is hand you the toolbox.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
You know, it's your house to construct, and I think you guys will be perfectly fine doing it no matter where you want to go. Mm-hmm. The first group that does it is really going to change the history of America going forward. I don't think that any city is going to turn it down once it's done.
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. Michael, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. So thank you for sharing your vision with us, and best of luck in your studies.
Thank you, Joanne.